Hello, I'm Anne Mossop, Sydney Writers Festival Artistic Director. This episode of our podcast was recorded as part of the 2024 Sydney Writers Festival. We hope you enjoy the conversation.
Hello, Sydney.
Look who it is. Look who it is.
Look who it is.
Oh, my goodness.
It's us.
We are the 2,000 luckiest people in Sydney right now. I would like to acknowledge the traditional custodians of the land that we are on right now, the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation, and pay our respects to the elders past, present, and emerging. Anne Patchett.
Meg Mason.
Part-time novelist. Shop assistant.
Yes.
Former journalist for titles like 17 Magazine and Bridal Guide.
I'm also the Mercedes-Benz magazine for the really upscale customers.
Mm-hmm. The only former waitress from TGI Fridays Nashville to go on to receive a Presidential Medal of Honor last year.
There's an important caveat, because I do think that there were some other members of the staff who got them earlier.
Sure, exactly. Right. That cohort I'm
That's
talking
right.
about.
That's right.
And according to Booksellers Weekly,
yes.
a minor TikTok sensation.
Yeah, yeah. No, it's quite a resume. I mean, I'm amazed myself, really.
Exactly. Yeah. It's why it's such an honor, why I'm so nervous.
I know.
You know.
Even though, Meg, we've had some time to warm up.
Oh, geez.
My husband and I came in for the Melbourne Festival, and then the Masons, Meg and Andrew, met us in Wanaka, and we spent 5 days on the South Island in a Defender. We didn't sleep in the Defender, but we drove all over the place. We went to the Milford Sound. We saw glowworms. We went to Glen Orchy and did a book club for 30 people at Mrs. Woolley's. I hope some of you were there. And then we went to Auckland. We did this in Auckland, and then we came here. So we're really warmed up.
What she's trying to say is we are both so sick of each other. It's outrageous.
Are you sick of me, Meg? Is that what we're here to talk about?
I'm getting there, but here's the thing. There was a time last week, earlier on in last week, where we were like, do you know what? Let's just keep these events professional. No one needs to know that we're friends. I'll ask you about your process and where you get your inspiration from. And quite rapidly, it became clear that it was...
We deteriorated.
It was just... Yeah. Once there was potato chip crumbs all over our
That's
laps
right.
and I was... Yeah. Anyway, yeah. But let's begin with the origin story.
Yes.
We were put in touch by our mutual publisher in the U.S., and you wrote me an email.
No, you're not doing a good job.
Yeah. See what, a week in the car with this.
It's been a lot of arm wrestling, and I am way bigger than she is. So, our origin story is this. Your editor, a very nice woman named Emily, who is at my publisher in the US, HarperCollins, had sent me a galley for a first novel called Valentine. And I read it, and I liked it very much, and I blurbed it. Now, just to put this in context, I get anywhere from 1 to 5 books a day sent to me. Hey, have you written a book? I don't want to see it. Did you bring me one tonight? Keep holding it close to your heart. So when it happens that I open an envelope and I take out a galley and I actually read it and I do this stranger the enormous kindness of blurbing the book, the stranger being the editor, and sending that book, the blurb, back in, she sent me another galley by return mail. And what a loathsome thing to do. That I had just done this person, who I did not know, an enormous favor, and she repaid my kindness by overnighting me another galley. And I had just emptied the recycle bin, and I thought, no, this galley is going straight in the trash. I am going to walk outside, and I'm going to throw it right in the bin. And so I went down the stairs with my copy of Sorrow and Bliss by Meg Mason in my hand. I stopped at the bottom of the stairs. I took another couple of steps. I'm reading as I'm going to the bin, and I'm standing in the driveway, and I'm reading Sorrow and Bliss, and I'm reading, and I'm reading, and then I turn around, and I go back inside, and I sit down, and I read the whole book in one day. Give it up for Sorrow and Bliss.
But what I wanted to know is
I'm
when...
I'm sorry, am I done? Is it your turn?
Yeah, it's... This is how this works.
I actually don't think I'm entirely done.
It's like the Land Rover all over again.
It's like Glenorchy all over again. Okay, so I love this book so much. And it was, what year was this?
2021.
So it's the middle of the pandemic, and I own a bookshop. And what happened to so many people during the pandemic is they lost their ability to read because they were anxious. And you would think that everybody was reading all of the time because we had time to read. And for some people, that was true. Some people were just really paralyzed. And the book I kept giving to people who would call a store and say, I can't read anything. Give me something that I can read. Give me something that I can connect to. Always it was Sorrow and Bliss. And always those people called back and said, thank you. That was the book that broke through for me.
And that was the book that you read over the yawning mouth of the rubbish bin, just like ready to drop it in at any second. And when
any
I finally
second.
Met you in real life and you said, what would you like to do in Nashville? What would you like to see? I was like, I want to see that rubbish bin.
Yeah.
And I want to see the distance from the stairs to the rubbish bin. And I want you to walk it out, reenact it, and tell me how long I had.
You took a lot of pictures.
Uh-huh.
People will say to me all the time, I mean, I will start a galley and I surely don't even touch most of them, but I'll give a book anywhere from one page to sometimes 50 pages of a chance before I throw it in the rubbish bin. And I was reading a book recently that I read like 50 pages of and then I threw it away, and someone else at the bookstore said, oh, and this is a book that of course won't come out for 6 months because I only read books that won't come out for 6 months. And someone said at the store, oh, you know what? You should have stuck with that one because around page 100, it gets really good.
And then it ends on page 104, it's a novella.
And I could care less what's good on page 100, but the magic of your book is not only did it have me from hello, it kept up the whole way. And that is what I'm always looking for, that I can open a page one, and think, oh yeah, I just went straight in. We're here to talk about your book
tonight.
We're
here to thank you so much for having me. It's a real, I'm so happy to speak to you. What made me really sad though, when I saw that rubbish bin, is to imagine how many literary friendships died unborn in that bin.
Listen, I don't become friends with the people whose books I blurb. Mm-hmm. I don't usually get thank you notes. I mean, I could probably count on one hand the number of thank you notes mm-hmm. that I've received.
Which is such a beautiful segue into this email that I'm now going to read some of, which was from you, that you sent it to me in March of that year, and it was called Thank You for the Thank You.
Because you had written me a thank
uh-huh.
you.
And it ended this way. I have an idea for a novel, but I haven't started it. I lie on the floor thinking. The dog crawls onto my chest and falls asleep. The thinking phase is his happiest time. It's all walks and naps around here. Once the writing starts, I'm upright and mobile, not nearly as much fun. I'm waiting for the plumber now, if you're wondering what today holds for me. Your potential friend, Anne. And what I want to know, reading that, is what's the plumbing situation now?
Anyone in my neighborhood would think I was having an affair with my plumber because as soon as he leaves, he turns around and comes back again. And I'm always glad to see him. Yeah.
But the novel went well.
The novel went well.
And this was the novel that
this
you were lying
the
on the floor thinking
this
about.
This is Tom Lake. That is the novel that I was lying on the floor thinking about. And that...
I haven't read it, but I've heard good things.
actually, I sent you a chunk of that book. You were the first person to read any of that book.
I was, and I tried, you guys, but she just doesn't take notes.
Because you should have stuck it out to page 100. It really does kick in.
I found my mind wondering. The point is...
What's this, the point, Meg?
The point is...
Yes.
You are rare in that you lie on the floor for 3 years thinking about the novel, and then one day you know it's time to stand up, and in the case of this book, get on the treadmill and start writing it. It's right. All in your head, which is a practice you actually begun at TGI Fridays.
Yes. When I was a waitress, I was trying to make up a novel, and I didn't have a lot of time because when I wasn't waiting tables, I was asleep or in the shower trying to scrub off the bacon smell. And so I would make up a story, and it was very much like having an imaginary friend, and it filled up my time, and it was very, very comforting. And that is how I wrote my first novel, and so it is the only way I know how to write a novel. And I do. I think and think and think. I take things out. I put things in. People get older. People get younger. I move it around. I think I have a really good idea. Something gets blocked. And as soon as I say to myself, this thing that I thought was so smart, it's not working, another door opens, another door opens. And it's not as if I have it all perfectly in my head and just then type it up, but I get to a point where I have a pretty good idea about the structure. There are a lot of writers who will say that they write in order to find out the ending of a story, and that is, hey guys, that is a really legitimate and good way to work, but everybody works differently. For me, I have to know where I'm going in order to get somewhere. So I have to know how the story ends. John Irving famously can't start a novel until he writes the last sentence. The first thing he does is he writes the last sentence. And then it is actually always that last sentence. And so you know what you're going towards. What was really interesting is that when I was thinking about this trip, which... When we were in the South Island, there was actually a blizzard. I mean, it was... How cold was it? Because I can't do your numbers.
It was cold enough that there was like 3 inches of snow stacked on the back of every sheep that we drove past.
Yes.
Snow that sheep. Cold. However cold that is.
Yes. It was really cold. And the Masons taught me how to use a word that I've been using my whole life.
Fresh. It's a bit fresh out today. It's a bit fresh outside. You'd never heard it before.
No. I thought that fresh just applied to vegetables.
Mm-hmm. And by the end, you were using it so naturally in conversation.
And now I'm going to go home, and I'm going to talk about how fresh it is outside, and everybody's going to think that I'm unbelievably pretentious, and I might as well have come home with an accent.
It's like when someone... When someone went on exchange for 3 months and came back, right. It's, what's the English word for, it's like that.
Yes.
But the weather got fresher and fresher as we went on, and by the end it was lethally fresh.
Right, so I am doing a lot of onstage events. Oh, by the way, do you like my dress? It belongs to Meg Mason. She mailed it to me. Like a year ago or something?
Now I sound like a psychopath. Like, I'm like, wear my dress. Put my dress on your body.
Well, it's because when you came to visit, I gave you a dress. Too short to be worn on stage. But there was a dress exchange. Anyway, when I was thinking about packing, I had to think about wearing dresses on stage, looking good, and that, or looking, you know, as well as possible at this stage in my life.
You can only do what you can do.
You can only do what you can do. But then also needing like a full-on winter coat and hat and scarf and gloves and all of that. And I found that I was thinking about packing the same way that I write a novel. That I was walking around thinking, if this dress, those shoes, I could do this, blah, 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 blah. And then I went upstairs one day and packed in 20 minutes. So that's sort of the same thing.
And there was so much talking about it beforehand.
That really no one wanted to hear about the contents of my suitcase because I had already exhausted them.
And we will get back to the novel. It's really important to talk about the novel. But the way that this email begins is it says, let us consider filling out the paperwork to proceed to actual friendship. I don't want to alarm you. You can take it as slowly as you like. And here's the thing about that. If I had have said to you, I'm ready to sign the paperwork, but there's a clause in it that says, in about 3 years' time, I want to take you to a cave full of worms and give you an existential crisis. Is that fine? Tick yes, tick no. Would you have filled out that paperwork?
I would have filled out the paperwork. I think I would have ticked no. So I sent you an email yesterday saying, read the Sebastian Younger. Did you by any chance?
No, I've been used all my free articles this month.
You've been a little busy. Okay. So there was a review in the New York Times the other day about Sebastian Younger's new memoir about the fact that he had a ruptured aneurysm and he almost died. And then all of the things that happened as he got better. Sebastian Younger wrote The Perfect Storm. And when I was reading the review, he said that after the aneurysm ruptured, he felt the presence of his father and this overwhelming blackness that was beside him and beneath him. And I thought, he went into the cave of glowworms. I felt the presence of my father.
Has anyone been to the glowworm caves in Tiano, bottom of the South Island?
Good, I'm saving you $100 a ticket.
Imagine.
Hey, guess what? They're not worms, they're maggots.
Okay, hang on. You're getting ahead. So
they tell you that after
okay,
you get
off the
boat.
Okay, do you know what? I'm from New Zealand. This is my.
You just
this is my...
paid $100 to look at vomiting maggots on the ceiling.
But in its defense, you have to crouch to get in there. And then you walk through, and it's like, has anyone been to the Small World ride in Disneyland?
There is just one moon and one golden sun, and a smile means friendship for everyone.
So it was like the sort of Dantean version of the Small World ride. So you crouch through a cave like this. When we asked in Auckland who has been to the glowworm caves, the entire
100%.
Room put up their hand. And so you crawl through, it's pitch black, there's a roaring river that goes through it, and then you get into a boat that was manned by...
A small drunk man.
Who had been working underground for at least 8 hours that day.
For at least 8 years. And he almost got the part of Captain Jack in Pirates of the Caribbean.
But he looked too much like Joe Pesci. It was a real mix.
Pulls you on a chain. We didn't know this beforehand either. In the pitch black dark through the ice cold rushing river. And guess what happens if somebody has an existential crisis on that boat and puts you all in the water? It's over.
But the thing is, New Zealand is a country that doesn't go in for a lot of warnings, a lot of waivers. It was just like, just don't do anything stupid. Don't fall out of the boat. Just keep your hands in and we'll go and look at some worms.
There are no...
that are actually maggots.
Say that one again.
Maggots. But do you know the funny thing was, the next day we went to the Milford Sound and we were waiting in that sort of terminal that has all the advertisements on it. And I'd paid independently for the glowworms and then I paid independently for the Milford Sound cruise. And you were like, oh my gosh, there's a deal. We could have got $10 off the glowworms. Do you want to go again?
I don't actually want to go again. But it is interesting. I'm not anxious. I'm not frightened. And that scared me to death. It really scared me to death. It was so depressing and upsetting to be dragged into the tunnel of your own death, just like Sebastian Younger. It was bad.
Yeah.
And
I
you
was
know what?
Fine.
I just want to say, do you feel Anne Mossop off stage thinking...
Festival director.
Thinking, get off the worms. Stop talking about the worms.
Well, they're actually maggots, but the point is, it was beautiful to see you have an existential crisis because you are the most unflappable person I've ever met. And I taunted you all the way through until I had one in the tunnel the next day that went down.
It was a tunnel, one of those where the red light stops the traffic and you wait for 20 minutes. What was that bird that we were looking at?
A kea.
It was a kea walking around, and then the light turns green and you go into the tunnel, which I think that they were still using a pickaxe to carve off a little more space. Uh-huh. One lane, but it went straight down.
Which is against nature to be in a tunnel going down. But it makes it sound like we didn't have a good time. We had a really good time.
And the tunnel didn't bother me at all, in the same way the maggots didn't bother you.
So together,
we're a perfect food group.
Okay, but tell me about this novel. Tell me seriously about this novel.
There are no
maggots
in it.
Where do you get your inspiration?
This is actually really interesting. I got a lot of the inspiration. I mean, I had started dreaming up this book before I met you. But a lot of the... hate it when that happens. A lot of the structure of this book had to do with you and had to do with our friendship. So this is what we haven't mentioned. We voice note each other. We don't email. We very rarely talk on the phone. But pretty much every day, we send each other a voice note that's usually between 6 and 10 minutes long. And it's I've never done this before. I've never done this with anyone, but it's like microtherapy. It's really wonderful. So one person talks and the other person is taking notes to make sure that their response covers all of the topics. And then later on, you make a reply and you say what's going on with you, but also you address what's going on with that person. But it's a real call and response. And it's a wonderful way to listen and to really think hard about what the person is telling you. And that worked its way into Tom Lake, because this is a story about telling a story. And also, while probably I would say 80 to 90% of what we talk about is present tense, the plumber is coming. This is what's happening today. I am working. This is what I'm going to make for dinner. This is what I am worrying about. This is how I feel. But then every now and then we drop back into the past and we tell each other a story, something that happened in our childhood or something that happened in college, whatever. And then those are always the great stories. And there's always that moment of, how did I not know this about you? I know everything about you. So that idea, I'm going to tell you a story. Here we are in the present, but then we drop back into the past. I'll tell you that story about the past. And I tell it, and then you stop and you say, no, I want to know more about that. Tell me more about that part. Or I say to you, you didn't tell me that before. Tell me more about that part. And that really gave me the structure for this book. So, Meg, thanks.
I didn't know I did that, but don't worry about it. what I love, and it's so seamless the way you do it, but one of the things I love the most about this book, and this sounds so basic, but it's really happy.
Basic is where it's at.
It's a happy book that made me feel happy. It's a rare thing.
It is a happy book. I always say it's a feel-good book about death. And many of my books lately have been feel-good books about death because that's where I'm at in my life. But yeah, it is happy, even though there is a lot that's stressful. There is a pandemic. There is a lot of talk about global warming and what's going to happen to the cherry trees and the decision about whether or not to have children and the decision about being able to make a choice about whether or not to have children. It's not that it's a light book, but fundamentally the people love each other. And therein in life lies the happiness. If people fundamentally love each other, if they have friends and family, and you know that you have that unconditional love and support that these people have. And I have this bookshop, and I read all of these books that are sent to me. Not all of them, actually only a small fraction, but I read constantly. And what I like to say is that dystopia has been covered. The apocalypse has been covered. Everything. And I mean that it's been covered brilliantly. Some of our very, very best writers are writing the very, very saddest books that are heartbreaking. Either they're going back in time to be tragic and heartbreaking, or they're going ahead to be tragic and heartbreaking. We've got this. But I'm not seeing in literature as much what I see in my life, which is there is so much horror in the world, but things on my block are pretty good. And I love my neighbors. They're fantastic people. I love my family. I love my husband. I love my friends. I love my friends. And I am the recipient of so much kindness. And it's very easy for me to be kind. And so the world that I am living, the known world that I am living, is one greatly comprised of kindness and happiness. The world that is being often interpreted for me or coming in through the news is a world of suffering and pain and misery. And both of those things are true. And we have enough space in our brains and in our hearts to hold both of those things. But what is a little galling is that if you write about a serial killer, you're writing the truth about man's inhumanity to man. If you write about someone who is a woman in her 50s with children who loves her husband, people are like, what do you know, man? That is so unrealistic. And I think, how many serial killers do you know? I mean, why is it unrealistic? So it's kind of my goal to write literature about the kinds of people I know. And here's the reason why it's possible, because I don't write the only book that is published in a year. So many wonderful books are written and published, and anything I do is a tiny chip in the mosaic of the much larger picture of literature. But I am allowed to be happy.
And we're so glad that you are.
Thank you. Thank you.
Which is not to say that it's not difficult. And I think that writing happy is much, much harder than writing sad. Because sad, you just put the woman on the bathroom floor and she can feel the tears running into her ears while the needles of rain pound against the window. You're done. But happiness, Flaubert who said, it's white ink on white paper, it doesn't show up. So when you were having a day on the treadmill, working away at the book, how did you put it in there, if that makes sense? How did you say, I'm going to write a happy dinner, I'm going to write it? What are the little touches?
Well, I knew my characters, and I knew how they felt. And I knew that Laura, the mother, like so many people, it was like the dark secret of the pandemic. The pandemic was horrible. The pandemic was death and suffering and hardship. But a lot of people were glad to have their kids home. And a lot of people who never thought that every day they would wake up with all of their family together were secretly quite happy about it and whispering about it, because nobody wanted to admit that there was a component of happiness to this horrible thing. And again, I thought, okay, well, the horrible thing's been covered. That's been well documented. But what about that little piece of light that a lot of people experienced? And I can remember when everything was locked down, and of course, lockdown in Nashville is not the same as lockdown in Sydney. Lockdown in Nashville, you know, just meant that you would go out with one gun instead of two. But you know, I would see people taking their kids to the park and riding bikes, and and slowing down. The whole world slowed down. And I felt that I was living my real life. Like I hadn't understood how much armor I put on every day to go and meet the world and to take all of that off bit by bit. I felt young. I felt like someone I had been such a long time ago. And so it was really easy to write those scenes, those dinners, because I was having them and my friends were having them. My husband was home. He was working from home. We had a friend who came who was living with us. There was so much joy in the house. And the friend who came who was living with us was a friend who was dying. But we were together. And we had such an appreciation of the time. There it is.
That's beautiful.
It's not like I'm sitting there thinking, happy, happy. What does it look like? What am I supposed to be writing?
There is a gorgeous scene in the novel, though, because it's so much about hot young love versus
right.
old married love, which was the first thought that was the germ.
Yes.
And there's a beautiful scene where all three daughters are suddenly out of the house and mum and dad make the most of it. It's gorgeous.
That's so nice of you. Yeah. Thank you. Yeah, they go upstairs. They go upstairs.
And she talks about how making him his favorite potato salad it's those flourishes, I think, to answer my own question.
Nothing is hotter than potato salad.
It's so true. That recipe will be available in the show notes.
And you know what? My friend Patrick said to me, it was the first book that made heterosexual sex look appealing to him. And I was like, so nice.
Yeah. And it's not an easy thing to do. Thank goodness for you. It was also the pandemic that turned you into a minor TikTok sensation.
Yes. Shall we discuss my TikTok sensation?
For someone who doesn't have a phone is now a minor TikTok sensation. Even watching her on someone else's iPad, it's so sad. It's like mashing it with her hands, trying to make the things come out of the iPad.
Right. So I don't have a phone, and I'm not on any form of social media. And I have to and I also don't watch television. I listen to the radio, and I read the newspaper as a piece of paper that I turn. And I think that also has a lot to do with my good opinion about humanity. And basically the peace and happiness that I am able to feel. So when I say to someone, you know, I'm not on social media, and they're like, well, then why do I see you on social media all the time? That's something that the kids at my bookstore make me do. And they don't show it to me, so I don't see it. But when we were in lockdown, one of the things that I was really worried about when the store was closed, and God bless everyone who kept us in business because people bought their books from our store while our store was closed. People ordered their books from all us. The orders came in from all over the country, certainly in our town. People would order books and then park out front. We would go and toss them into their car. We would deliver them. But there was a core group of about six of us that were working in the store. And the thing that really worried me was how would people know if they couldn't come into the store and browse and they couldn't get recommendations from us, how would they know about the debut authors? How would they know about the quirkier books that were being published? And we have a newsletter just for the staff about the books that come out on Tuesday. I don't know if you know this, but all books are published on Tuesday. It's true. In the same way that all horses have to leave the gate at the same time, all books have to be published on the same day so they can track the sales for bestseller lists. So on Tuesday, we have a kind of an inner office report of the books that are coming out. And I said, let's just publish this. Let's just make this available to everyone, because the person who wrote it did a great job. She was very funny. And she said, no, it's snarky and mean-spirited, and I don't want people to read it, but I don't want to have to be nice. And I said, okay, so we'll make a video. And so we started this thing called the Laydown Diaries. When we first started, I would wear a party dress. I would wear either an evening gown or a cocktail dress, because I live in the South, and I have them. And so I would get very dressed up, believing that if you wear a ball gown and hold your dog and hold a book, people will pay more attention to you. And then I ran out of ball gowns, and then I was just doing it in my regular clothes, or in your regular clothes. And they were really, really successful, these videos. And when we reopened, we had so many people say to us, I'm really glad that you're opening, don't stop the Laydown Diaries. And other bookstores watch them, people in publishing watch them. It's really mind-boggling. I also had a business partner for the first 10 years that I had the store. She was terrific. She made the store what it was. She did a beautiful job, but she didn't like backlist. She was only interested in selling new hardback books. I was always very interested in the old books, and it was a point of contention between the two of us. And
also the label maker.
Let's not be mean. She didn't like us to use the label maker because the tape was expensive. Anyway, so the day she left, she wasn't all the way out of the parking lot before we all started making labels for absolutely everything in the store. And I said, we're going to start doing a video called New to You on Fridays, where I would hold up a backlist book. So Big by Edna Ferber, I think, was the very first one that I did. And you told me to do Our Spoons Came from Woolworths by Barbara Commons.
Well, you told me around about the time of, you know, this friendship formation, I recommended a book to you called Owls Do Cry by the New Zealand novelist Janet Frame.
And I haven't read it yet.
3 years went by. She still hasn't
read it.
She's now been to New Zealand.
I will. The minute I get home, I'm going to read Owls.
Watch me on a panel talking about Janet Frame.
I am going to read Owls Do Cry.
Because you said to me, you can recommend books to me until the day you die.
Yeah.
And I will never, and this is before you stop swearing, which we will talk about later, I will never read them.
The volume is so unspeakably high.
But because I told you had just made a video about The English Understand Wool,
yes,
by Helen DeWitt.
Yes.
Which I want to hear that story. And I said, it's a companion volume. Our Spoons Came from Woolworths is a companion,
yes,
volume. And it was incredible to see what you mentioning it on those videos can do to a book that's been sitting, gathering literal and figurative dust for 30 years.
It's true. These books sell out all over the country, and publishers completely freak out. And it's amazing. I mean, you would think that I was a 14-year-old girl hawking mascara, but there are people who want a good book recommendation. A book that I am completely obsessed with is Niall Williams' This Is Happiness. And every time I make a video, it seems I am still holding up a copy of that book. There's a sequel coming out in October called Time of the Child, which is also spectacular. So if you haven't read This Is Happiness, please get that done before October so you will be ready to read Time of the Child.
And it operates a similar way to Tom Lake, because you think, oh, it's about a city, an island, when electricity was about to be brought to the village. It's not really about that.
It's not really about that. And it is a book about happiness and profound sadness. And when people say to me, I'm going through a great loss, I'm going through a great grief, recommend a book. And I always recommend Now This Is Happiness, because it really touches on that. But it also puts it in the context of your entire life.
Speaking of great happiness and great sadness.
Yes, please.
This is a bit of a world first announcement, apart from the 30 people that we spoke to in Glenorchy in New Zealand. You, a little while ago, got off your own bookshelf a copy of Bel Canto. And yes. It wasn't long before that that we'd been talking about Taylor Swift's versions of her albums. And you're like, I wonder if I could do a Taylor's version of Bel Canto. And then what happened?
So how this story began is that there is a little bookshop outside of Boston. And they had been hit really hard by the pandemic. And they were in a lot of debt. And they asked 20 authors to hand annotate a copy of one of their books and then send them in for an auction. And this was how they were going to bank money. And I did a hand annotated copy of Tom Lake, which means that I just got a book and I read it and I wrote all over, oh, this green coat that actually belonged to my friend Erica in college. And see, this is the first mention of Peter Duke. There's a light rain. Wait until the end when things fall apart and then see what the weather is doing there and see the cherries. They're doing this and this and this. It was really fun. And because I am chronically early, and if you give me an assignment, I will always be the first person to hand it in. They asked me to do it in August. It was due the first of the year, and it was done by September. And so, because that's just the way I fly. And it was such a compelling piece of work. I mean, I really learned a lot from it, and I enjoyed doing it. And I thought, I'm going to wait and hand it in later. I didn't love the idea of this thing that only was one copy going to someone I would never see. So what I did is I copied the copy in December. I got another copy of the book and I wrote it all out again. And I kept one and I mailed one. And you know, it was really funny.
What?
My friend Elizabeth McCracken was also one of the people who was asked to do this. And we were on vacation and we were having this conversation after we mailed it in. And I said, Jamie, the bookstore owner, sent me the nicest email. He said, my wife, Mary, says, this is the one that she wants to keep. And Elizabeth takes out her phone, scrolls through, and goes, yeah, he sent me the same email. I guess they just never thought we were going to vacation together. Anyway, so I took this copy of Tom Lake, and I thought, this is really kind of like a masterclass in how to write a novel. And there are a lot of people who can teach you how to write a short story, but there aren't a lot of people who can teach you how to write a novel. And I sent my copy to my editor and I said, how would you feel about doing this? I don't think we should do it with Tom Lake because it's too new, but one of the older books, either Bel Canto or The Dutch House. And Elizabeth and I were in Aspen when this was all happening. And that night, we did one of these together. And at the signing line, every single person who came through that line said, Bel Canto is my favorite book. I just want you to know Bel Canto is my favorite book. And I thought, okay, all right, I get it. I'll do Bel Canto. And my idea is to get other Harper authors, because it would have to be within the same publishing house, to get Barbara Kingsolver to do Poisonwood Bible, to get Louise Erdrich to do Love Medicine, to get Michael Chabon to do Cavalier and Clay, to get Edward P. Jones to do The Known World, and to have a series. And so I said to my editor, I'm going to do this. We'll get it to a point where we like it. And then we'll send a copy of it to these other authors and say, do you want in on this? Do you want to do this with me? And then we'll have an annotated series. And he was like, great. Because there are a lot of annotated books, but they're all scholars annotating the work of dead people. There really aren't books of living people annotating by hand their own work. So I set off to start working on Bel Canto, and while I was working on it,
which you hadn't read for 25 years?
I hadn't read it for 24 years. While I was working on it, my bookseller brain was ignited, and I thought, the first Tuesday in November is November 5th. You might remember, all books come out on Tuesday. It is also the day of the presidential election in our country. And I mean to tell you, there is not a book coming out between the middle of October and the middle of November. And I called my editor and I said, I'm going to homestead this thing. I am going to publish this book on November 5th because there isn't a book. And booksellers are going to need something to sell. And so then the whole process got wildly accelerated. And I said, I will take this to the other writers when we have a version that we can send to them. But it was a really, really interesting process in ways more interesting than Tom Lake. Tom Lake was interesting because I remembered everything and I really could identify all of the references. But the thing about Bel Canto is that it's a very, very good book. And, you know, I would never say, Tom Lake, it's a very good book. You know, I would never say that. But I frankly barely remember writing Bel Canto. And the things that I could see myself doing in that book amazed me. It's a very tricky, complicated Cirque du Soleil.
For the first 100 pages, everyone's lying on the floor, not allowed to talk.
Right.
In one room.
That is such a bad idea.
Imagine if you said, can you please write a novel where no one speaks or moves? They don't even speak the same language. All the best.
And it's about opera and terrorism, right?
That natural combination.
I mean, it's such a bad idea. And there were just so many things that I could write in the margin. I cannot believe I did this. I can't believe I pulled this off. This is amazing. But also, it's a terrible book insofar as there are approximately 70,000 adverbs in the book. Really weak, surprisingly, seemingly, hopelessly. There are approximately 7 commas in the book. Had I been frightened by a comma as a child? There is not a single M dash or semicolon in the book. There are so many misspelled words in the book. They're lying on a Savonnier carpet. I misspelled Savonnier. Actually, I spelled it a couple of different ways over the course of the book. And certain things got corrected in later editions. Savonnier, they took out the accent that I had put on, but it was still misspelled in later editions. I misspelled the name.
An otherwise enjoyable book was marred for me by the misplacement of the accent. That's what I put on Goodreads.
Was that you all those years ago? It is actually a real thing. If you make stupid mistakes, it pulls the reader out of the narrative. You have to have suspension of disbelief. So when there is, as there was, one sentence with the word no, K-N-O-W, 4 times in one sentence, chances are the reader's going to be like, what's up with that? Every time a woman walks into a room, she is identified by how her hair smells. And it smells of lilies, of lemons, of lilacs, or of grass. Every single time. Hair is spoken of as having weight and gloss 6 different times.
It's true. Hair does have weight and gloss.
Not, but 6 different times. When I wrote State of Wonder, Liz Gilbert was one of the first people to read the manuscript, and she said, you can't use the word ululate more than twice in one novel. You've used it 8 times. I mean, that's the kind of note I want. Mm-hmm. That is actually very helpful.
That's a practical note. And this thing, I've seen it, it's incredible. And now whenever anyone says, how do I write a novel? Teach me how to write a novel. You just slide that across the counter and say, check or savings.
Knock yourself out. Also, I think very good for book clubs and students. Mm-hmm. But also, it kind of doesn't matter. They're not paying me for it because I am super clever. And the book earned out its advance a long time ago. And so I said, I don't want you to pay me for the new edition. I want you to raise my royalty rate on all previous editions of Bel Canto. And so if this works, if you see that suddenly everyone's walking around with any edition of Bel Canto, you just stop and smile and nod and think, oh, that Ann
Patchett. I did feel sorry for you before when you said I ran out of ball gowns. I was like... Can we help her out? Can we do a whip round? You know? So I hope that really turns the situation around.
I'm hoping that it mm-hmm. will. But it's going to be very interesting to see how this goes. But it's kind of like no loss. I really enjoyed doing it. I learned a lot from doing it. They're not having to pay me to do it. And when I said that I wanted the marking to be in two colors. I wanted the grammatical marking to be in red, and then I wanted the notes to be in blue. And they said, if we do that, we'll have to print in China. Which means if you print in China, you can't get a reprint quickly. This is very important. So Amy Tan has a new book out called The Backyard Bird Chronicles, which is astonishing. During COVID, Amy Tan learned how to draw birds with colored pencils, and it turns out that she's as good as Audubon. I mean, these pictures are unbelievable, and she writes little essays about each of these birds, and the entire print run, because it's quirky and weird, and who knew if that would work, sold out in 2 days. Now there are no more books. Because of the colors, they have to go back to China, and it takes months to get the reprints of the book, so I said no red.
Monetizing the daylights out of everything that you do. I'm so impressed.
I used to say that as a child that I was born under the 13th astrological sign, which is the dollar sign. When I was a little kid, I was the weirdest little kid.
Well, this is the thing. So we discovered at one point in a voice note conversation that most writers that we know had a doll's house as a child, and it was a very significant toy. My doll's house, and I've heard you say before that the secret to a happy life is low expectations.
Yes, and that's really true.
Okay, so my doll's house was a Georgian pile with chimneys and sort of turrets and ruched curtains and real wallpaper and thick carpet and endless stairwells and a swan bed. And here I am, just serving you. Your doll's house was...
My doll's house, I don't know if you have tract housing. What's the equivalent for tract housing?
It would be like a prefab home, sort of like a low-cost, all many in the same street, kind of identical.
Yes, small, identical. It's what was built for soldiers returning from World War II, neighborhoods where there were tiny little two-bedroom, one-bathroom houses built. And my doll's house was a tract house.
Like low-quality, affordable housing. What toy shop was that? Where do you even get that from?
It was the toy shop of broken dreams. It was the toy shop of a reasonable expectation for how life would probably go. Yes.
But then you had a car accident.
Yes, thank goodness for that. So then my sister and I were in a car accident, and we were hit by a drunk driver on a Sunday morning, and my sister was in the front seat because she never once, even to this day, ever let me sit in the front seat. And she was much more seriously injured, and she got a settlement of $10,000, and I was in the back seat, and I got a settlement of $5,000, and I was probably 10 years old, 9 or 10 years old. And the money was put into a trust. And then when my sister got her money, she's older, when she got her money, when she turned 18, if she was 18, I would have been 14. and I found out that the interest was horrific. So after the lawyer's fees had been taken out of her $10,000 and then it had been put in the bank, it had just barely gotten back to $10,000. And at 14, I thought, well, that's for the birds. These people don't know what they're doing. So I petitioned the court to get my $5,000.
You know what teenagers are like.
To get my $5,000 back. And I remember the judge saying to me, you're just going to spend this on record albums if we give it to you now. And I said, no, the gold market is really heating up. And they gave me the money, and I got $5,000.
Whereas that's what I do with money.
I got $5,000 in South African Krugerrands. And it turns out that they fit perfectly in the refrigerator of the doll's house. And so they were stacked in the tiny shelves of the refrigerator. And I kept them for, if I was 14, I was 17. So I kept them for 3 years, almost doubled my money. And then I bought silver, because the Hunt brothers were cornering the silver market in Texas.
So don't ask Anne for writing advice or life advice, because there's so much backstory. It's like, I mean, but it's a joy. We only have a couple of minutes left. Tell us what you want to tell us. Just tell us, what do we need to know? You're going home, impart something.
I'm going home tomorrow. This is what I want to tell you. You have a beautiful country, and I feel an enormous sense of wonder being here and relief. There's so much kindness. It's been an honor to be part of this wonderful Writers' Festival and the exchange of ideas. I was at the opening night last night. And there is always, when you're in another country, a lot of heat about being an American, and especially about being an American in Nashville, Tennessee, where we have open carry of weapons without permits, and we ban books. And it's a nightmare, but you know what? It's also my country. And there are a lot of amazing things. Don't despair. We are not all freaks. I am honored to say that I actually know Joe Biden and Jill Biden, and I love them, and I believe in them. I believe in his goodness and how hard he works, how hard and without ego he works for the country. And anyway, don't despair. Don't give up on us. You know, Meg said to me, this was so killing. Meg said to me that when you were a teenager, all you wanted to do was get to the States, and that your girls, who are teenagers, think there's no way in the world, like, someone would shoot me as soon as I got off the plane. It really is a lot better than that. I want to say that there's so many good books being written. There is so much beauty in the world. And work for what you can do that you love. I want to say that you are my beloved, beloved friend, not only such a wonderful writer, but such a wonderful person, and you've arranged this trip. Hey, if you're glad that I'm here, that's the reason that I'm here. I came here to see you, and it's been nothing but a joy to be with you and Andrew and Ava and Daph, and I've loved every minute, and Christopher. I've loved every minute. The dog.
It's been wild. I have loved it. Don't despair. Work hard. There's plenty of beauty in the world. I still have your credit card number.
And I really hope you enjoy it.
Mm-hmm. I feel like I've earned it. Ladies and gentlemen, Ann Patchett.
Meg Mason.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, please remember to subscribe and to rate our channel.